Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today. Bananas today.
Nipple skulls, hot skulls, thick skulls, nipple skulls. Let's make this a blue evil.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
Welcome back. This is Pete.
I'm Pete.
And I'm his co-host, Ben. And this is another episode of The Henson Perspective. Today, we are talking about the episode guest starring Ruth Buzzy, which aired in New York City on October 11th, 1976, 45 years ago today. This is another relatively prominent Scooter episode with a couple of references to his uncle and the theater. Interestingly enough, this episode was filmed a week before the Jim Neighbors episode, which is where Scooter and his relationship with his uncle is introduced on the show canonically.
Interesting. Well, he's not named in this episode. He's just referred to.
Yes.
But yeah.
Scooter himself as a character and as the nephew of the uncle that owns the theater is introduced to the audience via dialogue in an episode that was filmed after this episode.
Maybe they knew already that scheduling-wise, they had to film this episode ahead of time. But then knew it wouldn't air until afterwards.
It's an excellent point that production and broadcast order is not necessarily the same as writing order. That they could have been aware of the fact that they weren't going to be broadcasting in production order, and so they wrote according to what guest stars they had and figured it out later in post.
Mm-hmm.
And this guest star is Ruth Buzzy, a famous person I know very well from having grown up watching reruns of Laugh-In, and I know nothing else because I was forbidden from doing research so that I could be quizzed on her later in the episode. But let's start off by doing a rundown of the various sketches and moments of the show before we then talk about the co-host and her specific contributions to the episode, by then closing up with our favorite moments of the show and statistics that we are tracking over the course of the series. Pete, why don't you start?
This episode starts with the credits, obviously, as it always does. It has a joke about a sure way to lose weight.
I finally found the sure way to lose weight. I bought a scale that lies.
Which is, I think, one of his best opening jokes that we've seen so far.
I get it, but...
So I liked this joke.
Mm.
I have in my notes for this episode many other jokes that I didn't get.
Oh, interesting.
So that will be an interesting theme throughout this episode of whether it worked for you or me or neither.
Excellent. I like it as a running premise. After all, we are doing a podcast about whether or not comedy works. So let's pay attention to whether or not the comedy works.
Then as the credits end, the gag for the Muppet Show sign is the sign raises before Gonzo can hit it. So he just kind of swings and whiffs.
And collapses, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I believe he falls over.
The opening bit is that Kermit gets out in front of the curtain and says, to celebrate, let's welcome the Mayhem Band. And we have a pretty great premise of a musical number wherein they're playing Sunny, a 1963 song by Bobby Hebb. But Animal is impatient with the tempo of the song, and as the drummer keeps on upping the speed at which it should be played.
Oh, Sonny, one so true, I love you.
Faster!
Sonny.
All right!
He keeps J.K. Simmons singing, saying, not my tempo.
Yes, but it does mean that they're rushing.
Not dragging.
They're definitely not dragging.
Well, the rest of the band is kind of dragging.
Because Animal's rushing.
Yeah.
At which point the speed of the verse increases until they all collapse exhausted. I thought that this was a fantastic premise for a sketch. I did a little bit of digging into the prevalence of the concept of the improv game 60-30-15-5.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to explain what that is to our audience?
It's called Half-Life is the name of the game. you do a scene that takes place in 60 seconds, then you try to hit all of those beats in 30 seconds, then you have the time again, and you have 15 seconds to do the exact same scene until you get to, everyone just has to scream their one joke that they got in that first 60 seconds in the 5 second one.
I've also seen on various online forums this referred to as fast forward, but the 60, 30, 15, 5 being the structure of how much time seems to be a nice generic name for it if somebody has not come up with a cutesy name for it for their particular improv group.
Fair.
I'm familiar with this exercise mostly as a thing that's been done in conjunction with Shakespeare, Perry's a lot. The Reduced Shakespeare Company, which was formed in 1981 and whose major first performance of all of Shakespeare's plays in one show was, I think, filmed in 1994, tends to end their version of Hamlet that takes place in the second act with a version of this technique. And, of course, it's something that Todd Luizzo does in his short film 15-Minute Hamlet, which stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Austin Pendleton. The basic premise being that they don't have enough film cans to film all of Hamlet. They just have one reel, so they can't have it be longer than 20 minutes. And then when he first screens it to his audience, they tell him it needs to be shorter and he has to cut it down to 5. So this premise of let's do it again but faster seems to have been ingrained in comedy for a considerable amount of time. I wasn't able to find an original premise. Like, I couldn't find a Del Close anecdote that said he came up with this or fill in the blank.
Yeah.
But I thought that it was an excellent escalation technique in order to do what the purpose of that exercise is as a comedic game, is to get everybody more and more frantic. The other thing that the sketch does, and we've already talked about this way too long, or I've talked about it way too long, is that every time they increase the tempo, they modulate up a key.
I love you.
Faster!
Sonic!
Sonic!
Let me see. What's going on?
Okay. So they're not just doing it faster, they're doing it higher pitched, which helps create a sense of escalation and franticness, because every time Floyd's voice goes up a little higher and up a little higher.
Well, one more thing.
Please.
Not to drag this out even longer.
When we're talking about something that goes faster and faster.
Yeah. And also to bring back a topic that I brought up many, many times of I don't like just straight up Muppet musical performances where it's just them doing or just playing their instruments.
Right.
This one I loved not only for everything that you just said, but it also has an amazing camera shot that starts behind Animal as he's playing and then sweeps around and Dr. Teeth looks directly into the camera as it passes him, and then it circles around until it gets to Floyd, and it's such a good shot.
They're aware that they need to do something to make these interesting. And so they've done a very clever camera move to make it active and exciting, as well as everything else.
So then after the mayhem, Scooter's uncle...
Scooter has a giant package that he's bringing on stage, a giant crate.
Scooter, what makes you think you can bring a crate into the backstage?
My uncle owns the theater.
And a nice crate it is, too.
Which is not a good reason, Scooter.
Yeah, especially when in the previous episode... you got a raise simply because your uncle owns the theater.
Let's take a second and delve into this. Since we talked about it in the previous episode with Scooter being introduced and the basic dramatic comedic tension around the reversals of Kermit saying this and then Scooter saying my uncle and Kermit reversing immediately, I have, in the interim weeks since we recorded that, noticed that I do think that that is a funny thing. That when somebody says one thing and then immediately reverses course, as you said in that episode, that's a funny bit. You're not wrong. I have found many examples of that in the subsequent days that have made me go, so why does this bother me so much?
Otis, are you wearing mascara? No. Yes.
Is one of your favorite jokes of all time. Right. For example, I've come down to a new thought process on why this bothers me. I think it's a character issue. We're supposed to like both Scooter and Kermit. And in these repeated scenarios, two things are happening. Scooter is deliberately manipulating Kermit with the power that he has, which makes him a bad person. If you're supposed to like Scooter, that's bad behavior. We're supposed to like Kermit. But Kermit apparently doesn't have the courage of his convictions. When he's threatened by the possibility of financial hardship with the person who hosts the theater, he caves. He collapses like a cheap card table. That makes us not like Kermit. I think underneath these jokes is less a problem of the reversal and less a problem of the performance of the reversal. It's more an issue of what it reveals about their characters or what it reveals about my investment in their characters from decades of involvement in the Muppets.
But it is also the second or third time we've ever seen Scooter.
Mm-hmm.
So your decades of knowledge don't exist yet.
Correct. But in retrospect, I find both of their actions to be reprehensible, and therefore I don't think it's funny because it grates against my sense of who they should be in the future.
Yep.
So even as an origin story...
Yeah, in 1976 this would have worked because you wouldn't have known all these things, but looking backwards, it is hard to get around.
Correct.
All right. I still think it's funny.
From the crate, we haven't even gotten to the the heart of the sketch yet. It's revealed that Scooter has purchased a mechanical wind-up TV show host, which is Kermit the Frog with a giant wind-up key in his back. The frog comes out of the box, proceeds to threaten Kermit with the fact that his uncle really likes the wind-up TV host, and then puts Kermit in the crate from which he emerged, giggles to camera.
I think the puppetry on the mechanical Kermit is fantastic.
Mm.
It's shades of Kermit, but also robotically done. It is so, so wonderfully executed.
The wind-up Kermit host tends to move his arms and his body like a wind-up mechanical figure in a cuckoo clock or that sort of thing, but talks mostly fluidly with a slight robotic tint, but mostly exactly like Kermit. And
we can get back to this later,
okay,
because there is a whole sketch about how they are the same later.
That's a good point. Once Kermit's put in a box, we cut to At the Dance.
And guess what, listeners? On Pogo George Watch, Pogo George is back.
Which is to say, Pogo George on production episode number 4 has not evolved past just doing the same thing. On the other hand, you get a shot of his dancing partner basically looking directly in camera. But it seems to me like she was making eye contact with me being like, oh my god, I can't deal with this dancing. We have our series of At the Dance jokes.
I wish they'd had rock and roll in the 40s.
Why?
He'd be dead by now.
So this is my first note of, I don't understand this joke. What does that mean? If
rock and roll had started in the 40s instead of the late 50s, early 60s?
We'd be dead by now. How? What? Why? Does the music kill you? Is it the fact that you would have then been born 20 years earlier? I don't understand any of this joke.
I can't help you. I did spend a hot minute trying to work out this exact structural difficulty that you've centered in on. I think it's that if rock and roll had started earlier, then they would have appreciated it when they were teens, which means they'd be dead now.
Okay.
But it doesn't really work.
Yeah. Unlike the opening joke, which is a joke, this is not a joke. This is an observation at best.
I think it's a temporal paradox is what it is. Then we have a mini runner within the At the Dance, which I liked. I liked the idea that you had cut back to this same dancing couple of what's referred to as the Blue Frackle and his dancing partner, that he has 3 feet.
You've got to be strong. You've got to stand on your own 2 feet.
But that's the problem.
What?
I've got 3 feet.
And we get 3 instances of his 3 feet being a joke in the course of the 6 or 7 jokes in At the Dance. So he'll do a 3 feet joke, he'll cut to another joke, and they'll come back to him. And I thought that was a good structural innovation in At the Dance that I appreciated, because when it cut back to the Blue Frackle, I was like, okay, we're going to escalate this joke.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you feel stupid with 3 feet?
Sure, but the other one didn't come back from the cleaner.
Yeah, it was really, really well done. All three of those are great. We also have Miss Piggy with not Miss Piggy voice.
Have I ever seen you in the movies? Well, I don't think so. I hardly ever go.
Which, another thing to track throughout this episode.
I didn't know when I was going to bring this up in this episode, so I'm going to bring it up now. From Brian J. Jones' Jim Henson biography, we have in the Muppet Show chapter a segment on this very issue. And it disproves my earlier theory about Frank Oz being inconsistent with the voice. That's not Frank Oz.
I also had a feeling that that may have been the case.
This is Richard Hunt. Richard Hunt plays Piggy twice in this episode, and Frank Oz plays Piggy once during this episode. In the middle of the chapter, we have a passage of Jones addressing this, saying, Piggy would continue to be traded between Oz and Hunt for a while longer, but gradually she became Oz's character alone. Miss Piggy was to have been a minor character, noted Jim, but Frank Oz gave her such a strong personality that she immediately became one of the principals. This also meant that Fozzie, who was originally intended to be Oz's main character, was regulated to a supporting cast as Piggy became his primary character, much in the same way that Rolf couldn't share much screen time with Kermit because Jim performed both puppets. So there isn't really a Piggy that is a character at this point. And while we previously were talking about the idea that this was because Frank was developing the character, that's certainly true. But it also means they didn't care who was necessarily doing Piggy in any given scene because she wasn't a character that anybody was emotionally attached to. And so Piggy is Hunt in this scene, which is why her voice is so completely different. And also why her personality will be so completely different in her third appearance in the episode.
Yes. Well, I'm glad I've been right this whole time.
I will come back to this page once we get to her second appearance in the episode to point out one more thing about this episode being particularly important in terms of Piggy's development.
So then, after the dance, we have Statler and Waldorf saying, those are some long legs.
Saying that Statler wanted to get up and stretch his legs.
That's
at which
right.
point, Animal says, I'll stretch your legs for you, and pulls yes. them out.
Very good.
And then we go backstage to the first of two dressing room sketches with a very weak intro where Kermit narrates to the audience why he's about to look at himself in the mirror.
Time soon for the handsome frog here to make another one of his introductions. I will check myself and see how I look in the mirror.
It's completely superfluous expository narration that is the weakest part of this particular bit. At which point, Kermit and his wind-up robot double do the mirror sketch from the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
It's so well done. I mean, the mirror sketch from the Marx Brothers has the two Marx Brothers acting in perfect sync with each other so that you basically can't tell that it's not a person in front of a reflection. And to have had two Muppeteers do effectively the same thing, where they are so in sync in terms of the physicality of the squishing of the face and the moving of the arms, and that sometimes it's in sync and that sometimes the Muppet robot double deliberately does the opposite in order to taunt Kermit with his unreality, and then they snap back into sync. That is a physical dance coordination that must have taken forever.
I'm curious as to whether if Jim was doing both of them at the same time and then there were other people controlling the arms.
It's an interesting possibility.
Because he would have then been able to choreograph, and his hands would have had the muscle memory to, this is the scrunchy face, this is, and then to know, I'm going opposite this time, and you wouldn't have had to coordinate it with two different performers.
It's a very interesting idea.
After that, Sam the Eagle introduces Wayne and Wanda, where they sing Row, Row, Row.
Young Johnny Jonesy had a cute little boat.
And all the girlies I would take for a float.
Which is their longest sketch yet.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most successful even though it's still not successful, Wayne and Wanda sketch.
They basically do the entire first verse and the first line of the chorus before their show collapses, whereas normally they get maybe four lines into the first verse before something goes wrong.
Yeah. And it's also the first Wayne and Wanda sketch where Kermit doesn't interrupt it and the curtain doesn't drop.
Mm.
It just wipes to the next sketch after the boat capsizes, which I thought was all interesting.
Part of the difference there is that it really is a sketch.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a musical number, as opposed to
a blackout joke.
Correct. Thank you for coming in with the correct terminology that I would have fished for a solid 30 seconds.
Then we have a Muppet Newsflash. So the Muppet Newsflash is the wipe that mm-hmm. clears the Wayne and Wanda. And a very convoluted joke about the Atlantic Ocean being kidnapped.
Disappearance of the ocean was first reported by lighthouse keeper Murray Patterson. He was awakened late last night when 500 fish pounded on his door asking for water.
But New Jersey has the entire ocean. I enjoyed this. None of it made sense to me.
I'm going to introduce a certain bizarre concept mm-hmm. to you.
Please do.
Nonsense.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
When things don't make sense, they're just absurd.
Yeah.
It's like surrealism, except done not to shake you out of the cold confines of pedestrian reality in order to have an artistic awareness of the world and to elevate your senses, but to just make you chuckle.
Yeah, but I still want some sort of logic thread in there.
You want a logic thread to somebody stealing the Atlantic Ocean?
Yeah.
I'm going to direct you to Daniel H. Pinkwater's children's book, Fat Men from Outer Space, in which they steal the Atlantic Ocean by drinking it through straws and then spitting it out into pickle jars.
That's believable. Get enough pickle jars, you could do that.
Also, you know what happens when you steal the Atlantic Ocean? The other oceans flood into it. And so you don't steal the Atlantic Ocean, you then just lower all of the oceans.
Hey, man, you might be onto something for saving this planet. As the oceans rise, we just get a bunch of pickle jars, put that Atlantic Ocean in these pickle jars, blast them off into space, Miami's okay.
Well, if that's the benefit of going against global warming, I'm not sure I'm for it. Miami is acceptable losses. Anyway, I thought that the logic chain or the surrealist leaps in this were amazing. It was absolutely one of the best bits in the... But it's my particular brand of humor.
See, the thing that I liked about this that saved it for me was how the newsman got frustrated and threw his papers and walked out at the end of it. Like, he knew what he was reading was trash and was just like, I'm done with this. I very much enjoyed that part of it.
Moving, quote, swiftly, unquote, on, we get to Kermit introducing Ruth Buzzy as a lady you know from Laugh-In and a bunch of other shows.
A lady you loved on Laugh-In and hundreds of other shows. A comedian, an actress, a singer, a dancer, and a lot of fun at parties.
And at which point Ruth and Sweetums do Can't Take My Eyes Off of You.
We will return to this later.
Mm-hmm. We then have the ad break and come in for Rolf doing the UK spot. Has upgraded very slightly from its normal lit scrim of a bland background to now having a drop that sort of looks like a music hall, but it's still the UK spots are identifiable not just because they're frequently a musical number that has almost zero popular recognizability, but also because they have the bare minimum of production values.
Yeah.
At which point he sings I Never Harmed an Onion from 1955.
You may not know this, but I'm really a very sentimental dog. I cry easily. Onions, for instance, always make me cry.
That's more recent than last week's, 1906. I will say about this spot that, unlike my other takes, I actually enjoyed this song and I didn't really like the performance.
That is a weird take.
Yeah, I said not my favorite Ralph performance, but the song is pretty good.
This song is just a litany of food puns.
Yep.
And Rolf's performance is great. You're a madman.
So I think I like Rolf better as a piano player than a singer.
Ah.
Because I like the moves that he does while he's playing. And if he's singing, he can't do those smooth head movements as he's jamming out to the music. He has to be singing.
Whereas my visual memory of him flopping his ears back and forth while he yells, potatoes I've mashed and berries I've crushed, like, that is in my repertoire of hilarious comic bits that I carry around with me at all times. Like, I think the way he throws himself into, I'm doing something to emphasize these lyrics, but I can't do it with my hands because my hands are busy, is great choreography. It's one of the reasons I love Rolf as a character, is because he's doing bits on the keyboard, he's doing bits to camera, and he's also basically chair dancing.
Mm-hmm.
That combination of three different perspectives of action in the puppet is why he's so wonderfully versatile.
I agree. However, I didn't feel it in this one.
Madman. Madman.
Hey. Bye.
However, we have the talk spot.
Yep.
Which we will nimbly leap over until we get to the Ruth Buzzy segment. And then we have Statler and Waldorf legitimately just saying,
wonderful, marvelous,
that you could care for me.
Yep.
Wonderful.
Marvelous.
That you should care for me.
Did you get this one?
Something else I don't get.
This is the lyrics to a George Gershwin song, made popular in the musical Funny Face, which was made into a film with Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn in 1954. Why do I have that information at my fingertips? Only the past knows for sure.
Thanks, Muppet Show, for recording episodes out of order and then releasing them in an order that then allows us to know these things.
But also, it's a bit that I have done, as you know, for a really long time, where if somebody says a word or a phrase that's lyrics in a song, I then say the next lyrics in the song instead of singing them. That's all they're doing. If they take the cheers, it's wonderful, it's marvelous, and then
say the next line in the song. Yeah,
yep.
Okay. Except, yeah, it's a bit that I do as well.
But the two of them are confused by the fact that they're doing it. I think they are aware that the audience probably isn't going to get this bit, and so they make the Muppets confused to alleviate the confusion on the part of the audience. That's my hot take.
Fair. Kermit then introduces Fozzie, then we get the Fozzie segment.
The man with the fur and the funnies, I believe, is how he's introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another segment that is a very specific, as we've seen a number of times now, back and forth between Statler and Waldorf and Fozzie. It's as if the rest of the audience doesn't exist. It's just a back and forth, except for the fact that the rest of the audience does exist is the crucial crux, if that's not redundant. It's totally redundant. Between their interactions at this point, because it turns into a reversal.
Who's doing the show, you or me?
Well, we're getting all the laughs.
This is my act. And you're the greatest straight man in the business. You've never been funnier.
Never.
Which he takes as a win.
And gets off stage.
It's a pretty elementary reversal concept, but very elegantly done, and I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very good. I liked it a lot. Then we have Ruth Buzzy as a soldier being interrogated sketch, mm-hmm. So we will return to this.
And then we have our second of the two dressing room sketches.
Oh, light of my life, frog of my arms, at last we are alone.
At last you are alone, Piggy. I'm about to go on stage in front of 1,000 people.
So she lets herself into his dressing room to swoon and moon over him in his absence and discovers the mechanical wind-up TV host inside, mistakes it for Kermit. It whispers sweet nothings in her ear, which then become offensive. When Kermit comes back, she thinks he's the person that's been whispering terrible, gross things in her ear, karate chops him, at which point when the wind-up TV host reintroduces itself into the equation, she gets confused and faints on the beat-up Kermit on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved every bit of it. It's also the first time we get a Miss Piggy hiya.
Piggy, let me explain.
Oh, explain this.
literally, this is the first time in the history of Muppets. In the script, and this is the other bit that's in the biography, in the script, it was just written as a punch. And Oz ad-libbed the karate chop instead. So the idea of Piggy becoming a martial artist, of being a person who does the infamous hi-ya before she strikes, all of that is the character extension of Piggy that came from Oz developing the character, which only happened when they stopped treating her as an interchangeable character that anybody could do at a moment's notice.
Yeah. And I just wanted to emphasize, as you did the hi-ya, as Piggy infamously does, this is more of a hi-ya.
Yeah.
It is not as emphasized. It is just a quick, I'm going to karate chop.
That's right. Because it wasn't her thing yet.
Right. But we get to see it.
In its infancy.
Yep. I liked it.
We then go to a very quick, what'd you call it, a wipe? The street gag.
Blackout.
Yeah, we have a blackout street gag. Your son, the hotel, is thinking about becoming a monastery. End of scene.
Hey, Ben?
Yeah?
I don't get it.
Okay.
I wrote this down verbatim.
Yes.
One house says,
I hear your son, the hotel, has become interested in religion.
That house responds,
Oh, interested isn't the word. He's seriously thinking about becoming a monastery.
Is it wordplay? I don't get it.
So, when we were talking about the headless guy a couple episodes back,
mm-hmm.
I brought up the idea that I sometimes look askance at jokes in The Muppets that are written predicated on the unreality of the fact that the Muppets are Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels like a cheap gag to say, don't lose your head over this, just in order to have a headless Muppet walk by. The flip side of that is you start getting jokes that are quick character-based things. Is it this episode or the previous one where in the dance somebody says to Rolf, I have a bone to pick with you. And he says, oh, too late, I've already buried it. I think it's this episode.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That's a joke that's just there because you have a Rolf who's a dog. You could have done it with Baskerville, but it's done in order to say, dogs bury bones, the phrase, a bone to pick with you. That would be different to a dog. Okay, let's have a dog character respond to this. Fairly simple elementary writing process, but also only works because you have dog puppets. Otherwise, it's not really funny, because the unreality of having a dog character is pervasive.
Yeah, I understand it, and I think it works with the dog one.
But you have house puppets, so the premise goes the same. Okay, if you're a kind of a house, can you become a different house? If you're a church and you leave the faith, and you're defrocked, can you become a Howard Johnson's?
Looking at it, this now makes more sense to me.
It's character-based humor when your characters aren't real people.
Yeah, I think it needs one more step to make this a joke of something, because a monastery is a hotel for monks, essentially.
Yeah.
So that needed to be in this to make it a joke of he used to be a hotel, but he stopped charging and a whole bunch of monks moved in, so now he's a monastery, or whatever it ended up being. But just saying, oh, he's thinking about becoming a monastery, that isn't a joke. I already buried the bone is a joke.
It's funny. I mean, I'm not a professional humoridian, so I can't argue with your premise of what is or is not a joke. I understand that.
Fair.
But briefly, premise conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Premise twist conclusion. That's essentially the structure of a joke, right?
Yes, humor is the subversion of expectations.
Yeah. So in this, the premise of there are houses who are people, the conclusion being, can a house therefore be other than its construction? What's an example of that? How is that not an attempt at premise and conclusion?
It is an attempt. It is not successful.
Fair enough. That's what we're here to analyze. Also, I'm not here to defend the house sketch.
Yeah.
As a wipe, it does its job.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes up 15 seconds of airtime.
And it provides a transition from the previous sketch to the next sketch.
Yep.
I'm not claiming I laughed at this. I am merely saying I think this makes sense within the Muppet universe.
Yeah.
The way in which they write gags is predicated on a certain perspective of what would this unreal thing, how would that be real?
One might say a Henson perspective.
You're fired.
Thank you. Have a good night.
At which point we cut to Sam and Ruth Buzzy introducing the final musical number, which is a strange thing.
Excuse me, don't pay any mind to me, Miss Buzzy. I merely stand by checking the content of this program to make sure it is morally above reproach.
Yeah, because let's just talk about this now, because there's no point in talking about this in the Ruth Buzzy segment, because this is literally all it is.
Uh-huh.
They introduce this not as the closing musical number. They introduce this as the closing number.
Kermit has asked me to introduce this week's closing number.
And then there is the Googalala Jubilee Jug Band next. And then a whole other sketch after that.
Sketches are not numbers. It is the final number.
Okay, fair. But for me, when that happened and they said the closing number, and then for there to be another sketch after that, I was like, wait, what? This is wild.
Whereas to me, the idea that your guest star would be introducing the final act that apparently doesn't have her in it was wild.
Yeah.
When you've got celebrated comedian and multi-talented personality Ruth Buzzy, and she's saying our final big number of the show is somebody else, you've wasted something.
Yeah, I was very happy to see the sketch after this one to occur, because
why would
then it to go from that to credits would be absolutely bonkers.
But instead, because the structure of the show is, for whatever reason, her collaboration with the writers, they decided to have the final bit not be a musical number.
Yeah.
And so the final outro is a comedy sketch as opposed to a musical number sketch, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do with a really great comedian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, was a subversion of the, hang on, this is only episode 4.
Yeah.
It's a subversion of what we think a Muppet Show should be for 45 years of Muppet Shows.
Yeah. So she introduces the
Googalala
Jubilee Jug Band, and they sing a song. It's boring, but it's catchy. But the Jug Muppet is excellent.
The Googalala Jubilee Jug Band, according to the trivia track on the DVD, mostly doesn't exist after the first season.
Hmm.
There are definitely a couple of the members who continue and other things, but they're mostly replaced by what's referred to in the track as the Country Trio, who we saw in the Tomorrow sketch, where you have a Muppet that looks an awful lot like Jim Henson and a Muppet that looks an awful lot like Terry Nelson. And so most of our country music bluegrass numbers will be performed by them with the jug blower and the grandpa, but the other toothless, eyeless, hillbilly Muppets will mostly fade away.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just briefly say that the Jubilee Jug Band is playing a song called You Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd, which I assumed was a camp song.
Mm-hmm.
It has that quality of Boom Boom Ain't It Great to Be Crazy,
yeah,
where you've got a thing and it's combined with another thing and these two things don't go together. Let's sing a refrain that's the same every time.
Yeah.
We can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. No, you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd.
You can be happy if you've mind to.
Weirdly enough, this is a legitimate country song from a legitimate country record from 1965 by a guy named Roger Miller. So that was a surprise. Not a comic song, not a camp song.
Yeah.
Just wanted to point that out, how wrong I was. And then we get to the final sketch of the show, which is the panel discussion, where Ruth Buzzy is playing Miss Gloria Goodbody. And the topic of conversation for the day, as Kermit introduces to our panel of Gloria, Sam the Eagle, Miss Piggy, and a random pig, is the human body obsolete?
So let us come back to that in a moment.
Right.
Also, notice it.
At the the close of which we then have Statler and Waldorf saying, "It's wonderful," with no joke.
Yep, just them saying, "Bravo, wonderful, bravo."
Which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And good. As of yet, unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut back to in front of the curtain where Kermit says that we wanted to thank our special guest star, Booth Buzzy.
Except he says Booth Rezzy because it is revealed that it is Mechanical Kermit.
And then the credits roll, and Statler and Waldorf's final joke is that Waldorf is also stuck as a mechanical glitch.
Yep, he says, "No, I didn't. Hick. No, I didn't. Hick. No, I didn't." And then end of episode.
So all that's really left to talk about are the Ruth Buzzy parts.
But before we get to that, Ben, how much do you know about Ruth Buzzy? Not Booth Rezzy. I didn't write any questions about Booth Rezzy.
Oh, I prepped. I studied for Booth Rezzy.
No, well, too bad. You get Ruth Buzzy.
Been sitting here in the Rezzy booth for ages.
Ooh, I like that and I hate that. So question number one.
Hit me.
This is the fourth episode of The Muppet Show that we've covered. Which of the previous three guest stars has Ruth Buzzy not previously worked with? Rita Moreno, Jim Neighbors, or Sandy Duncan?
Rita Moreno.
That is correct. She worked with Sandy Duncan, as you talked about in the last episode. Maybe if we weren't recording these back-to-back, wouldn't have written this question. in Laugh-In and also the Disney thing that you talked about. And she worked with Jim Neighbors on The Last Saucer, the Sid and Marty Krofft thing.
Oh, okay.
So question number two. Ruth Buzzy was raised in a town that matched her father's profession. Which of the following is the town / father's profession? Bakersfield, Maryland. Her father was a baker. Gardner, Massachusetts. Her father was a gardener. Or Stonington, Connecticut. And he was a stone sculptor.
Gardner, Massachusetts.
Stonington, Connecticut.
Wow!
He was a nationally recognized sculptor who carved the eagles that used to be outside of Penn Station. Angelo Peter Buzzy is his name. Question three. Which of the following is not listed as one of Ruth Buzzy's current hobbies? A. Automobile collecting. B. Painting. Or C. Sculpting.
Ooh, well written. I'm going to say, despite the fact that it is a apparently very popular pastime, she's not an automobile collector.
Incorrect.
Yeah.
She is not a sculptor. She and her husband have quite a car collection. They donated many of their cars to museums, and also one of their cars was featured on the cover of an issue of Vogue. Question four. Ruth Buzzy is very good with technology, as in, I believe, a 3-year-old woman. Which of the following websites is Ruth Buzzy not on? Is she not on Cameo? Is she not on TikTok? Or is she not on Twitter?
She's not on Twitter.
Incorrect.
Ugh.
Not on TikTok.
Mm.
A cameo from Ruth Buzzy currently costs $500.
Blimey, Charlie.
She donates all of that to charity. And she has 149.7 thousand followers on Twitter. Her Twitter is funny. It is very good. We don't need to include these in the edit.
Yeah.
But I have a number of her Twitter jokes.
All right.
That I want to share with you.
Yeah, please.
Written August 25th, 2021. I don't always go the extra mile, but if I do, it's because I missed my exit. Also, August 25th, don't sing in the shower. Singing leads to dancing leads to slipping, and slipping leads to paramedics seeing you naked. So remember, don't sing in the shower. A couple more. August 4th, I've done a few things I'm not too proud of. For instance, I've sold my homing pigeon on eBay 211 times.
All right, no, we're going to end with that one unless you think the last one's better, because that is a dynamite punchline.
That's it. We'll just end it there.
Congratulations on coming up with an excellent selection of why she's great on Twitter. What's her Twitter name?
I believe it is Ruth_A_Buzzy.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, she's great.
All right, hit me with number five.
Ruth Buzzy is an alumni of the Pasadena Playhouse. Which of the following were not classmates of hers? Dustin Hoffman, Gene Hackman, or Leonard Nimoy?
Nimoy.
That's correct. Nimoy was around for 6 months, I believe 3 years previous to her.
Mm.
got 2 out of 5. So, now that we've learned a little bit more about Ruth Buzzy, except not really, just a bunch of trivia about her. Or, we actually learned more about her father than we did about her.
We learned where she's from, who she attended the Pasadena Playhouse with, and...
She's very funny on Twitter.
But yeah, not much context about her career or her existence in 1976.
No, but I think out of the... And yeah, I should have taken our audience into account. But I think out of the 4 people that we've
talked about so far,
you and I are both most familiar with Ruth Buzzy. Mm-hmm. So it would have been... It was harder for me to then go into credits and things to... Because you would have definitely known more about her than that.
And has had a consistent career since about 1969.
She is still working. She has a movie coming out next year. Or this year.
And is great in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Reverse of my feelings on the Sandy Duncan episode.
Hmm.
I didn't like most of the non-Ruth Buzzy stuff, and I loved all of the Ruth Buzzy stuff.
Interesting. If you don't mind, then, let's skip straight to the talk spot.
Okay.
Because I think that's an interesting angle of comparison. What I highlighted last week is that I thought Duncan and Fozzie did a really good job of talking naturally, of communicating their laughter. Buzzy is doing a thing here with Kermit where she's talking over him and interrupting him, and it felt to me very much like a performance. She was incredibly good at what she did, but it felt like a dramatic exercise where she had a point she needed to get to and just had to figure out how to do it in character or in process in 3 or 4 sentences.
Well, yes.
This is lean. Lean. El Lino, Kermit, my froggy friend.
Yeah. Well, I can see all that, yeah.
Kermit,
well,
I had a friend once who chewed so much fat.
She was a steamroller, and she was very funny, but her lack of collaboration with Kermit made it a less successful sketch to me than the way in which Duncan and Fozzie were equal partners in their semi-improv, semi-scripted way of doing it.
See, that's really interesting that you say that, because I felt the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I have written down, best talk spot yet, Ruth is very funny and effortless. Going back to the Rita Moreno episode, where the whole conceit of that was that it's cue cards.
Yep.
The fact that you mentioned that they're talking over each other is so hard to do if it's scripted. Mm-hmm. Because then you get that stilted, like, oh, I'm supposed to, and you're supposed to cut me off here. But this felt like, with them talking over each other, that it was probably more improv.
I compared it to the We Have Ways of Making You Talk sketch, the interrogation sketch, where I thought she was more successful at the same concept.
Hey, lady.
And he went with a general's daughter named Maggie.
I don't care.
Oh, she had a mole on her left shoulder.
Hey, I'm warning you, we have ways of making you stop talking.
Listen, now, the other pilot...
Mm-hmm. Her character in both of those is you can't stop me from talking. There are a lot of talking to camera moments in this episode. There's a great one of Kermit looking directly at a camera and saying, I've lost control of this interview, while Buzzy is laughing. But it also meant that there wasn't a lot of interplay to that. It was a vehicle for Buzzy to let loose. And I found that to be more successful comedically when it was the premise of the sketch, which is what it is in the We Have Ways of Making You Stop Talking sketch.
Yeah.
And Frank's vocal frustration as the Blue Frackle was great, where he was performing vocally, being overwhelmed, whereas Henson as Kermit mostly waits for her to stop. He gets beat up, he grumbles, but he's not talking. So you got that overplay and over-talk in the interrogation sketch that you didn't have in the talk spot.
Yeah.
In the same way. There's nothing wrong with her performance. It's just that it felt less collaborative.
Okay.
That's my defense at length as to why I thought one of them worked more than the other. I agree. I think this one's funnier. Structurally, I liked the other one more. But funnier goes a long way.
Yeah.
And I understand... at the drop of a hat, why anybody would like this one more. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, sure. Speaking of structurally,
yeah,
let's talk about the set of this talk spot, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about this because, so Ruth Buzzy mentions the way she gets people to laugh is she tickles them.
Yes.
And then she tickles Kermit.
Yes.
And Kermit ends up falling backwards over the wall, and she follows him over the wall.
So good.
And the way we've all imagined the Muppet Show and Sesame Street sets to be built is they're always on a rise.
Mm-hmm.
And the performers are standing under them and lifting over. But also, Jim Henson used to perform Kermit from behind the couch of The Tonight Show.
Right.
For her to go over the wall, it had to have been more of a couch situation and not 6 feet up.
But then it couldn't have been a man-sized gap for her to fall into on the other side of the wall, is what you're saying.
Right. So therefore, because it goes quick, did Ruth Buzzy then fall onto Jim Henson as she goes over the wall? These are all things that are not answerable, and I love every bit of it.
Legitimate theory, because I also noticed and thought about this. I think she is on an elevated set, and there is a man-sized gap on the opposite side of that wall. Because as she goes over, she doesn't tumble.
Right.
She is very clearly being lowered. I think there are two other grown men on the side of that wall who have caught her and are bringing her down into the gap.
All right.
Because the way she goes over is like a controlled fall.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's part of what's funny about it. It's not a collapse. It's not a... There's no tumble. There's no loud clash of limbs. There's a very surreal moment of her body sort of not at gravity, not at 9.8 centimeters per second per second, descending on the opposite side of that wall.
Let's jump to the first sketch.
Yes.
Because I think that's the exact same way she falls in the...
You're just too good to be true?
Yes.
You're just too good to be true.
Ooh.
Can't take my eyes off of you.
Can't take my eyes off of you.
When she's standing on the table, or she's laying down on the table and she falls off the table and doesn't hit the ground. It's probably the same exact skill,
yep,
quote-unquote, I'm falling off of something safely without actually falling.
I also want to mention Richard Hunt. Richard Hunt is the puppeteer and body in Sweetums. Richard Hunt is Scooter. Richard Hunt is Robin. Richard Hunt is Beaker. Richard Hunt plays all these little characters.
And Sweetums.
And Sweetums. I think Richard Hunt... I didn't have a chance to find this out. I think Richard Hunt must be a big physical guy. I mean, even acknowledging that Sweetum's head is probably as tall, if not taller, than Richard Hunt's hand above his head to do the eyes and the mouth. But he carries Ruth Buzzy around. She climbs on him. I think he's got to be a very strong, very big guy. And it's therefore fascinating that he plays this nebbishy gopher, this tiny child frog. That his characters have often been little second bananas, and yet at the same time, one of his most prominent roles is a huge physical being. I think there had to have been something fascinating going on there.
Mm, yeah, because you just said it all. The physical performance of both Sweetums and Ruth Buzzy in Too Good to Be True is fantastic. I loved every second of it.
Well, I mean, so the end sketch of her talking about physical fitness, she gets up on the desk, she's doing stretches, she's doing yoga.
This is yoga.
What are you doing? Doesn't that hurt?
It wouldn't at all surprise me if that came out of a conversation with her. I think it's clear that she was probably still is, a very strong, very physical performer. She was probably a dancer.
She was, yeah.
Yeah, and she knows how to control herself. Those falls off the table behind the desk could have been because somebody was carrying her, could have been because she, as a physical person, knew how to safely, slowly curl herself down on the opposite side of that wall instead of jumping over and collapsing and therefore possibly hurting herself.
Yeah.
The same kind of strength that she did in order to do those arches on the debate desk and to hang on to Richard Hunt as he carried her around. was probably the same strength that she had in order to, even if there was a gap on the other side of the wall, safely lower herself down.
Yeah.
Just really obvious core strength in her as a performer and a movement artist in those scenes.
Do you have anything else to say about Too Good to Be True?
I merely wanted to point out to your earlier note, her lip syncing is not great.
Mm.
I think one of the things that's necessary to pull off the humor in the sketch is she does have to be smiling the whole time, because otherwise it's weirdly abusive. And so I think in order to accomplish the physical requirements of falling and hanging and swirling and dipping while being upbeat, she loses the accurate lip sync to a big grin a lot of the time. That said, it's so clearly her voice on the recording, mm-hmm. and she's so good, you really don't notice it. But once you start paying attention, you can see that she's actually shockingly not lip-syncing for most of the song.
Which is interesting, because this is one of the few times I didn't take note of that.
Yeah.
I was so enthralled with everything else that was happening.
Physical performance is so good, you almost don't notice.
Yeah.
But once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Oh, thanks for ruining the sketch. quick non-counting pop quiz.
Mm-hmm.
Who hits whom more? Does Ruth Buzzy hit Sweetums more, or does Sweetums hit Ruth Buzzy more?
All right, so he stomps on her twice. She hits him with a chair once. He hits her at least once more than that. I think he has to hit her more than she hits him.
It's 3-2. Sweetums, yeah. Sweetums hits Ruth Buzzy one more time, yeah. Because she then stomps on him once she knocks him out.
Okay.
With the chair and then blows him down.
Yep. After he's dazed, yep. Knocking him over just by blowing on him.
So then we talk about the talk spot. Let's talk a little bit more about the soldier being interrogated.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on it briefly. Again, such a good sketch. It's a classic comedic premise,
mm-hmm.
of being interrogated by whomever, them wanting the information, and then you giving too much information, and they get frustrated because they don't want you to talk that much.
And she's extraordinary in it. I mean, she just, the amount of detail that she has that she can't stop giving to him, the way she puts her arms around them at the end, and is, they just can't escape because she's just in full gossip mode.
I mean, he was really terrific.
Please don't do anymore. Stop. Don't talk. Please don't do
it. It is a bravura performance.
Mm-hmm. It's so good. We talked about that, her introducing the closing number, and then we touched briefly about the chat panel. Is the human body obsolete? Then we talked about how she does yoga on top of the desk.
Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to reinforce here is that this is Richard Hunt as Piggy.
Right.
Because Frank Oz is Sam. But also because, despite the fact that Piggy was willing to throw herself at Kermit in his dressing room, the only bit that Piggy has in this is they're talking about physical fitness, and Piggy says, in her non-Piggy voice,
"Well, I'm fit.
Let's get physical."
And they basically just make out for the rest of the sketch, which is an incredibly weird thing to do when earlier you've talked about Miss Piggy being infatuated with Kermit.
But this is a sketch, and that is quote-unquote real life. So this is a acting role.
Potentially. It depends on whether or not she's, I mean, she's not introduced.
Right.
So we don't know if she's Miss Piggy in this, or if, like Ruth Buzzy, she's playing a part. Either way, she has almost nothing to do because Frank is playing Sam.
Yeah.
And therefore, she isn't really a character in the sketch. It would be less distracting to me if they had done Janice, if they had done anybody else. If they had done the loudmouth dancer from At the Dance, I would have much preferred it. Except I don't know who does that voice, to my shame.
And then as Kermit loses control over the chat show again, he says, "Well, we're running out of time. Next week's topic is crowd control and riot suppression."
It's still the best part of that sketch.
Yep. Even though this sketch is, from top to bottom, very good, I liked everything that Ruth did in this. But yeah, that's still the best.
The joke. Closer of, we're going to respond to next week's topic by what went wrong with this topic, is a good bit.
Yeah. Then, in the outro, the only thing that we didn't touch on with Booth Ruzzy is that they call back the tickling, because they all come out and tickle her because she tickled them so much throughout tonight's episode.
And just to say that touching another person without consent is not great, and I'm sure that Ruth Buzzy herself was okay with it, but a massive group conspired tickle in any real circumstance is not cool. I would like to mention that one of the group of Muppets that shows up to all be joyously excited during those 5 seconds before they cut to credits is a Muppet beach ball.
I don't think I noticed that.
It's front and center before it quickly gets pushed off screen. It has no arms. It can't tickle her. It's just there to be happy, yellow, and excited in the middle of the screen before going away. I've never seen it previously. I don't know from what it was created, but I wanted to point out just how weird it was.
Fair. Fair. So that's the end of the episode, so let's talk stats before we get into our top five moments.
Please.
There were 12 hits in this episode.
Wait, 12? Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking explosions.
No, there were zero explosions, okay. Zero kisses.
But we haven't had that many hits in a while.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the most since episode one.
Right. The last couple were considerably quieter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ruth Buzzy hit Kermit twice. And then we covered the Sweetums, and then there were 5 other hits throughout the episode.
Including the Piggy.
Yes. I think they were either all or all but one of them were the Piggy beating up Kermit. Musically, this episode was back to over the 40% range. It was 40.57% music.
Mm.
Also had the longest musical number of the whole show so far. Too Good to Be True was
yes.
over 3 minutes long.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't cut out the musical bridge. They had the dancing part of it, which was funny, and it was a popular song, so they found a way of doing it. But yeah, that song was not excerpted the way in which a lot of the musical numbers will take a 5 first song and cut it down to 2 or 3.
Yeah, and Wayne and Wanda was the longest yet as well, but good still
point.
Under a minute. So we're up to 87 hits for the whole series so far.
The hits just keep on coming.
They do. Still at 2 kisses, still at 4 explosions. And that's all I got for stats.
As always, we close each episode by talking about our 5 favorite moments. A moment is not a full sketch, but it is a piece of dialogue or action or performance that makes us stop and appreciate it, and we want to share it with you all. Pete, why don't you start with one of your top 5?
All right. I have, in the We Have Ways to Make You Stop Talking sketch,
mm-hmm.
the shadow work at the very beginning.
I agree.
That I don't know what it was, but there's, as the sketch is introduced, there's just 3 shadows, human shadows, crossing the stage as the camera pans down to reveal Ruth Buzzy. And I didn't understand it, but I loved it.
It's a way of creating the mise-en-scene of she's in a prison. It's a way of creating stakes that can then be subverted by the sketch as she goes from scared, reserved person to over-participant. It's, I think, part of what makes the sketch work so well is there's a momentary sense of menace before it's completely subverted.
Yep.
I'm going to have in the Gogoloth Jubilee Jug Band that the final line of the song, there's been a repeated chorus of "You can be happy if you put your mind to it," is the old grandpa fiddler saying,
"But you can be happy if this is the end of the song."
And I agreed completely, but also his semi-old, semi-drunk delivery was really redolent of Mark McConville in Super Ego. It had a particular, I'm slightly out of sorts and I'm breaking the fourth wall quality to the delivery that really resonated with me in terms of the sort of thing that he's been channeling for a lot of his comedic career. And I'm sure that's wholly accidental, but it was a positive association, and I like to think that this might be part of his DNA somewhere.
I very much enjoyed that too.
What do you got up next?
So in backstage sketch with Piggy,
mm-hmm.
when a mechanical Kermit says, "Let me whisper," and then he pauses, switches sides to her other ear, and then it says, "Let me whisper sweet nothings into your ear."
Sure, let me whisper sweet nothings in your ear.
I don't know why they switched that. I don't know if it was intentional or if it was a goof up where he was like, "Oh no, I'm supposed to be on this side," but I loved it. I just thought it was so funny that he had to go to her other ear to whisper the sweet nothings.
I think for camera reasons, for blocking reasons of Kermit being knocked out, I think there were lots of reasons why Debbie had to be on that side. My guess, obviously, neither of us knows, is that they didn't have a way of doing it naturally. Mm. And so they made a point of doing it unnaturally because it was funny and because they needed to do it. So why not just do it as awkwardly as possible?
I'm going to continue to think that it was the performer being like, oh no, I'm supposed to be on this side. I started the line here, but no, I have to be over here.
I'm going to point out a moment in the Ruth Buzzy talk spot, which is that after Kermit has made the joke about you shouldn't be in favor of dairy products killed my uncle, and Ruth reacts with horror and shame for having brought this up. He says, oh, don't worry, I didn't write that joke.
That's awful, Kermit.
Yeah, well, don't blame me. I didn't write that.
Oh, it's a joke.
Yeah, it was just a joke. That's up to the laugh track. But speaking of laugh...
In general, I have brought up the laugh track a lot in this series, so I appreciated the fact that the awareness of the fakery of the laugh track was part of the structure of this joke, that Henson and or the writers and or Kermit were at a place where they just couldn't not mention the fact that whether or not this joke was a good joke would matter more to the post-production engineers than it did to whether or not the joke was actually good. And the fact that there is a slightly sweetened laugh after that was just the, no pun intended, icing on the sweetness cake.
Sweetums cake.
No, Sweetums isn't in this scene. I always love breaking the fourth wall. That was a great instance of it. I appreciated it. Thank you for doing that, writers or performers. It was wonderful.
As the final moment, there are two moments in the chat panel at the end. I'm just going to combine them. There's two separate things.
But all right, hit it.
The confusion of what yoga is.
Right now, I'm into yoga.
Yoga?
Yes, yoga.
Isn't it that weird sour milk stuff?
Which is the perfect Sam comment.
Yeah.
Weird and sour milk stuff for a perfectly ordinary but slightly fringe because it's about health. That's 100% Sam's perspective on something.
And the other part is Ruth Buzzy's exhales as she's doing her yoga are so funny.
Well, that's about all the time we have.
What's going on?
They're so small and, they're big, but they're so minor that it made me laugh.
Well, especially because it's in absence of a written joke is that she's doing the performance of the yoga. If she was just stretching, it wouldn't be nearly as funny as if she was performing the full body breathe. Like, that's a woman who's done yoga, who's done Pilates, who knows a certain kind of person that's like, saying, look at me over here, I'm getting healthy, and she's channeling that person.
Which is clear that it is true from the rest of the the sketch of the...
Right,
the,
of her physicality and her ability to do all those marvelous bits.
So, just wrapping up, I mentioned earlier, Sandy Duncan, I didn't like the Sandy Duncan parts, I did like everything else this episode, I didn't like the non-Ruth Buzzy stuff, but I love the Ruth Buzzy stuff.
And since we're ranking guest stars and not overall episodes,
Ruth Buzzy, coming in at number one right now.
Wow.
I took a peek ahead at the other guest stars. There are some other guest stars I like. Could dethrone her, but...
Your overall method of ranking people is that you are placing them where you think they might stay for the rest of the season, even with unwatched episodes to come.
Yep.
You have a strong bet that you think she could stay number one, even with 20 episodes to go.
Yep. I liked every bit of every Ruth Buzzy sketch.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Continue to tune in to see if any of the other marvelous 70s personalities who are on schedule to come in over the course of season one could possibly dethrone Queen of Laughin' and, as Kermit says, almost everything else on television, Ruth Buzzy.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast the Salmon Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan, Emily, and Dan Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
There are things, dates, facts, names, weird dairy products, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben. And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 3, guest starring Joel Grey.
Yeah!